Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 132. I'm recording it on Wednesday, April 29th, 2009. The PE10 level today is 15. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The music for the podcast is by Kevin McLeod at Incompetech.com. The name of the selection is Lacaine. The title of the podcast is Cash is a Strategic Investment Class. I've been posting lately at a couple blogs, posting comments, and one of the blogs I frequent is the Four Pillars blog. And there was a blog entry there today on asset allocation, and brought to mind sort of an old, I don't know, pet peeve I have regarding how people speak about cash. And there's a I'm gonna go through that in this podcast, explore the implications of that. I'm gonna start by telling a story that, unfortunately, the punchline is sort of missing, but for historical purposes, I think the stories are worth telling. Cash is a strategic asset class. If you understand what that means, I hope by the end of this podcast you'll understand what that sentence means. If you understand what that means, you are a rational investor. The conventional way of thinking about cash is cash is for an emergency fund. The conventional thinking today is, this is the passive investing era thinking, the conventional thinking is you get rewarded for taking on risk in investing. So stocks are the most risky, so stocks have the best returns. Bonds are not as risky as stocks, but pretty risky. They provide a good return, and cash is not risky at all. Cash is safe, and so cash is sort of a waste of time. But everyone acknowledges you have to have some cash, because they'll say, oh, you know, you might have your car might break down, so you have to have an emergency fund, or you might lose your job, so you have to have enough money to get you through 6 months of unemployment. So you need to have a little emergency fund, and for that, you don't want to have it in stocks or bonds, because there's too much variability, too much volatility in the price. So you want to have that in cash. So the conventional advice today is put most of, you know, asset allocation is a debate between stocks and bonds. And sometimes people get a little more complicated and they'll throw a little bit of gold in, you know, 5% gold or something. But as a general rule, when people talk about asset allocation, they're saying, how much to put in stocks, how much to put in bonds. And then again, some people will split up the stock part. They'll put some of it global and some of it U.S. and some of it small cap and things like this. But in general, when people talk about asset allocation, they're talking about stocks and bonds. And then you've got this thing on the side called emergency funds. And that's cash. Money markets, maybe, something like that. I reject all that. And a simple way of saying it is, a simple declarative sentence that says it is, cash is, it's not something you have an emergency fund. Cash is a strategic asset class. Cash has characteristics that stocks do not have, and that bonds do not have, and the gold does not have. And you need to think about cash strategically. We don't have all the answers. I can't tell you exactly how much cash to have. I can give you tools to help you figure it out. But there is no one answer for everybody. It's going to vary. So there is no one answer. And we don't have all the answers, even if there were only one. We don't know everything we need to know. But I am confident that cash is a strategic asset class. It's not just something, a throwaway, that you put your emergency money in there. You invest in cash to grow your portfolio just as you do the other asset classes. You know, stocks and bonds and gold and anything else. And the point of this podcast is to make that point. Rob Arnott, the last couple of podcasts I quoted, I gave a quote from Rob Arnott, and I'm almost at a point where I'm thinking of quoting this Rob Arnott quote in every podcast I do for the rest of my life, because it sums everything up so clearly and so well. Rob Arnott is a big name in the personal finance field. Rob Arnott was, I believe, for 4 years, he was editor of the Financial Analyst Journal, which I believe is the most prestigious journal in the field, certainly one of the top. So this is not a, you know, guy who doesn't know what he's talking about. And Rob Arnott said, I can give you the exact quote if I take just a second. The conventional wisdom of modern investing is largely myth and urban legend. Boy, does that ever hit it on the head. You know, it just tells you right out of the gate. It doesn't tell you what to do. It doesn't tell you all the answers, but it tells you got to have an open mind. You can't just say, well, because 90% of the quote-unquote experts say it, it must be true. That's wrong. The experts have overplayed their hand by a factor of 50. They've come up with some good theories. They're all smart people. Not everyone, I suppose, but everyone I've run into is smart. But they came up with some insights, and then they just ran with the thing, and they just got way, way, way ahead of themselves and got themselves and all of their listeners and readers and followers and the entire U.S. economy into a whole lot of trouble. And they need to pull back. And most of this conventional wisdom is myth and urban legend. So please, don't take anything I say as gospel. Just because Rob Bennett says it doesn't make it true, that's for sure. But don't take anything they say as gospel either. Listen to both sides. Judge for yourself which side makes sense. And, you know, explore, think, check the historical data. Try to figure it out. And maybe you'll come to something in the middle. I don't know. But whatever you come to, you have to have confidence in. And if you don't have confidence that you figured it out, not the fine points, but that you figured out the basics. If you haven't figured out the basics, I'll just tell you my take. My take is if you don't understand the basics, the ABCs of investing, you shouldn't be invested in stocks, because stocks are dangerous for those who don't understand. Invest in something safer. Accept that you're going to get a lower return. One thing I agree with the experts is you have to invest in stocks to get the best possible return. So on that, we're in agreement. But I say, if you don't understand stocks, and if you don't understand why cash is a strategic investment class, I say you don't understand stocks. If you don't understand stocks, my personal thought is you should not be in stocks at all, or else you should go with a very low allocation, 30%, something like that. 30%, I suppose, can't hurt you. So I wouldn't have a problem with that. But not much more than that if you don't understand the ABCs, in my opinion. Now, I want to tell the story to set it up, and then I'll get into the more fun stuff. But I am I believe in keeping records. So, you know, the great safe withdrawal rate debate has been this amazing series of discussions on the internet, and I try to keep a record of it all. I try to keep post archives on my computer, and at this point, I have thousands and thousands of files, so many files that I can't find anything. You know, it's the problem of if you don't keep something, you'll end up needing it and regretting it. But if you keep everything, you can't find what you need. But I always say that the great debate began on the morning of May 13th, 2002, because that's the day I put the post to the Motley Fool discussion board saying that the old school safe withdrawal rate studies are analytically invalid. These are the studies we use to plan our retirements, because they're analytically invalid because they don't count for the effective value, the valuation level that applies on the day the retirement begins. So all the numbers are wrong, And that means we're going to see millions of busted retirements in days to come. And all of that was caused by this excessive confidence in the passive investing model, a model now discredited, in my opinion, by the academic research of the past 30 years. But the truth of the matter is there's actually one document that I would say goes back earlier than May 13th, 2002. And, you know, I discovered the flaws in the old school studies not in May of 2002. I don't know the date, but it was mid-1990s. And the key date was a date when I read John Bogle's book. I think it was called Common Sense on Mutual Funds. And he explained where stock returns come from. And when I read that, it all clicked in my head. And I said, hey, you can't determine the safe withdrawal rate without knowing the valuation level. So I knew the numbers were wrong. I didn't know what the right numbers were, but I knew the numbers in the studies were wrong. I knew the safe withdrawal rate had to be a good bit less than what the studies were saying. There was one point. Bill Bernstein is the author of the book, The Four Pillars of Investing, and at one point, I read Bill Bernstein. That was his second book, and his first book he published on the internet for free. And a lot of people were excited about it. This was the years when stocks were going through the moon. And I read it. And I think it was late 1990s. I think 1999, but I can't be sure. And Bill had a website. And he would put up new articles there, a couple articles a month. And one of his articles had said something about cash. And at this time, I was thinking in my head, I was putting all this stuff together, putting my plan together, my retire early plan. And I was looking at this issue of cash being a strategic asset class, and Bill put up something indicating otherwise, and I wrote him an email. So that was literally the first document generated, I think. It was sort of a precursor to the great debate. I got no response from Bill, so it didn't go anywhere, but I would love to look at that document today. I don't have it because it was on my computer at work, and then I left that job and, you know, turned in the computer, and you know, it's no longer there. I no longer have it, but I wish I had it because it would be funny. It would make the same basic claim I'm making in this podcast, but I imagine that my understanding of the issues is much more sophisticated today with 10 years, you know, of experience looking into these issues. But anyway, That's neither here nor there, but for historical reasons, I thought I should note that there is such a document. Perhaps Bill has it in his file somewhere. He didn't respond. He wasn't too excited by what I said. I came up with the line, cash is a strategic asset class. There's a woman, and I can't recall her name. Somewhere I have a record of what her name is. It was a poster at the Berkshire Hathaway board, also in the late 1990s, and I used to follow that board at Motley Fool. And they were having a debate. The name Mary is coming into my head, but I don't know if that's right. That doesn't seem quite right. But they were having some kind of debate. And that was her whole post. I think that was the whole post. Maybe there was one more sentence. But her post was essentially in this thread, cash is a strategic asset class. And I just loved it because I understood exactly what she was saying. It just clicked with me totally. I had come to that conclusion myself, and I don't think most people think of it that way. They don't think of cash as a strategic asset class. And if you come to think of cash as a strategic asset class, it's so much. It's like turning on a light. It's like turning on a light switch. Everything is illuminated. All kinds of things are illuminated. What risk means, how stocks work, you know, what asset allocation is all about, why people get so emotional about investing issues, you know, how people fell for the passive investing stuff. All this stuff gets illuminated if you just understand what it means to say cash is a strategic asset class. Cash is not just for emergency funds. The whole game of investing is deciding. Well, so now we're getting into the meat. The game of investing, it's about risk. As a general rule, the passive investing people are right when they say, as a general rule, risk is going to be correlated with return. If you're not willing to take risk, you are going to have low returns. So if you put all of your savings into money market accounts, you're going to have a long wait till retirement because you're not going to get good returns. All that is true. They start from a reasonable place. So there is a need to take on risk. And the big issue in investing is how much risk you're going to take on. If you take on too much risk, you sink the boat and you end up with nothing. You'd be better to be in a money market than to have nothing. But if you take on too little risk, you delay your retirement because you're not going to have good returns. The whole investing question is, what is the right amount of risk to take on, and how do you figure that out, and how do you stick with it? If you do that, you're doing the right thing. If you're taking on the right amount of risk, you're doing the right thing. You'll do the best. If you take on the right amount of risk, you will obtain the best returns you can obtain, and you'll be able to achieve financial freedom as early in life as you could have done it. You know, somebody saving as much money as you did would have been possible, you know, to have done. So that's the whole game. And when you throw cash out of it, you know, they're essentially making it sound as if, well, here's the thought. The thought that is driving the passive investing mindset is that there's no risk in cash. I think that's it. In their heads, they think that the game is to take on risk, and they think of cash as being risk-free. And if it's risk-free, it's not worth much. And so they say, well, you know, use it for your emergency fund, but that's it. Cash is not really risk-free. I'll try to explain why. There was a post I wrote once at the Motley Fool a long time ago. It was around Easter. I think it was Easter Monday. I have a funny way of recollecting dates. I believe it was Easter Monday of 2003. That could be wrong, but that's my guess. It's probably still there if you go to Easter Monday of 2003. It was called, and it was a thread starter, and I called it Risk Without Risk. It's a funny title, and it's important, but it's I don't think it's a hard to understand concept, but it's a slightly subtle concept. Go to the stock return predictor at the website, and look at the return you could get. Now, when I talk about cash, I don't mean just money market accounts. I mean money market accounts, certificates of deposit, I-bonds, treasury inflation protected securities, any asset class that is essentially stable, let's call it, rather than risk-free, let's say stable. But the common way of saying it would be risk-free. You know, a non-volatile, an asset class where you know what you're going to get from the beginning. If you compare what you could get from TIPS, Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, in January of 2000, TIPS were providing a return of 4% real. Stocks were providing a long-term return, a 10-year return, of a negative 1%. That's the most likely. There was a range of possibilities, but that was the most likely return on stocks. Could have been as bad as a negative 4%, could have been as good as a positive 2%, but the most likely scenario was a negative 1% return. So cash, what we're calling cash, TIPS, were providing 5 full percentage points every year for 10 years better than stocks. Now, that's probably the most important fact of the entire Great Safe Withdrawal Rate debate, because if that fact is true, passive investing is loco. Makes no sense to invest heavily in stocks when a risk-free asset class is providing 5 percentage points better return. I mean, it just makes no sense at all. But 90% of the investment experts were telling you in January 2000 to put your money, most of your money, in stocks and very little in TIPS. Maybe, you know, what you need for an emergency fund, that's it. The reason they do that is they start with the premise that a risk-free asset class cannot offer a better deal than stocks in the long term. They, of course, acknowledge anything can happen in the short term. But they say it can't be better in the long term. Cannot. And I say they're wrong. And the reason they say it cannot happen is they say returns are always correlated with risk. And I say they're wrong, but they're not entirely wrong. The proper way to see it, I believe, is that you are compensated not for risk, exactly. You're compensated for perceived risk. You're compensated for perceived risk. So what happened in January of 2000 is stocks had had a long run-up. From 1975 through 2000, stocks had been going up, 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 25 years. So the perceived risk of stocks was nil. You couldn't get anybody to say a bad word about stocks. It was almost impossible. If a mutual fund manager lowered the stock allocation of the fund, he'd be fired in a week. Stocks had no risk, no perceived risk. But cash was perceived as high risk. How many times did we hear in the 90s, people would say, oh, I'm a little worried about stocks. Prices are awfully high. They'd say, oh, but stocks are best for the long run. You might not lose any money in those money market accounts, but don't forget, inflation is eating up your money. You're not going to be able to retire. They say, in a sense, cash is really more risky than stocks. There were hundreds of articles that argued this. I remember reading them during the 90s. In a sense, cash is really more risky than stocks. Now, when people said that, they were sort of playing a little game. They didn't mean it 100%. They were sort of playing with the definitions. Because if they really thought cash was more risky, they would actually think that cash would have a higher return than stocks, and they would have invested in cash, which is just what the truth was. But they were playing a game. What the people who argue the passive investing model do is they say that stocks are risky and therefore stocks have a great return, but they don't really believe it. They believe it's a theoretical risk, but as long as you're a smart passive investor, you don't have to worry about it, because in the long run, stocks are always best. So they sort of make it sound like if you're smart as they are, smart enough to be a passive investor, that risk is immaterial. You're sure to get that 6% real return in the long run, and all's well. But the risk, implicitly, they don't always spell it out, sometimes they do, is that cash is really sort of risky because it's not stocks. That's why. Only stocks are best for the long run. So you're allowed to say stocks are risky in order to explain why they have such high returns. But when it comes to investing in them, you're supposed to pretend they don't have any risk. And cash, you're allowed to say is risk-free because you want to reassure yourself that cash is always a bad thing and risk-free asset classes don't provide good returns. But you're allowed to think that cash is risky because you want to stay away from it. So you'll say cash is risky because I'll be falling behind to inflation, but with stocks, I don't have to worry about that. Oh, no. If I choose the riskiest asset class, I can never fall behind. That's always the best. What I say is that it's perceived risk that is correlated with return, not actual risk. And in the year 2000, the perceived risk of cash was sky high. The perceived risk of stocks was nil. Therefore, the long term on stocks was a negative number. Any money you put into stocks in the January of 2000 was likely over 10 years to give you a negative return. Lose money. But cash, you could get a government guaranteed Treasury inflation protected security and get 4% real every year for 10 years. 4% real. 5 full percentage points higher than stocks. Now that's exciting. That's exciting. You know, you can go to one of these calculators that you know, they're always telling us if we save money how we get compounded returns. Well, take a look at how much better your return would be if every year for 10 years, you get 5 points real better. And add it up. and then count the compounding returns for 30 years out, you know, on that higher return, and you're going to be able to retire 5 years sooner. Just by making that one change, just by knowing to move your money from stocks to cash in January of 2000. My point here is, stop thinking of cash as this boring asset class that, you know, it's for little old ladies and losers. Cash is exciting. Cash is how you achieve financial freedom early in life. Cash is how you achieve your life goals. Cash is how you open up opportunities. Cash is how you open up free time. Cash is how you break free of the man. Cash is exciting. Stop thinking about it as being boring. And one way to say it is, it's a strategic asset class. Now, is cash always exciting? No. No. We're now heading into a time where cash is in much has much more appeal to many people. So the perceived risk of cash is down, and therefore the long-term return on cash is down. Cash is arguably still more appealing than stocks. Arguably, stocks are more appealing. You can make arguments both ways today. You can make arguments both ways today. I would argue for something in the neighborhood of a 50% stock allocation today, which means 50% stocks and 50% some cash-like instrument like TIPS or I-bonds or CDs. So today it's sort of a close call. But from 1995 through 2008, it was not a close call. Cash was the better place to have your money. But that is not generally the case. That is certainly not generally the case. Those were extraordinary times. Those were the most insane stock prices we have ever seen in U.S. history. So don't think that's the norm. But the whole problem with the passive investing model is people come to think that that is the norm, which whatever is happening out there in the current day, they think is the norm. And they think it's just, you know, they say, oh, stocks provide 6.5. And people were thinking from 1995 through 2008 that stocks were going to provide 6.5. No way, Jose. Not at those prices. Not when they're selling at those prices, they don't. At those prices, stocks provide a very low long-term return. And cash can generally beat it. Now, so cash is very exciting. Now, one of the things that bothers me, you know, I always talk about how we've been held back. You know, the passive investing model was discredited 28 years ago when Robert Shiller did research showing that valuations affect long-term returns. We should have started having doubts about passive investing immediately. I don't say that we should have abandoned it immediately, because you never are going to take one study and say this proves everything. What we should have did was, it should have been front page headlines. And then we should have continued researching it and thinking about it. We should have had that, the national debate I'm always talking about that we need to have today, we should have had that back in the early 1980s when Shiller did his research. And then if we had had that debate then, by the late 80s, when further research came in confirming what Shiller had done, then we could have abandoned passive investing altogether and moved to the rational investing model. But what happened is, I think, the mutual fund industry spent hundreds of millions of dollars promoting passive back at the time when we all thought that it was the way to go. And then after having spent hundreds of millions promoting it, they didn't want to back down. And as a result, they were reluctant psychologically to admit the mistakes. And so they've compounded the mistakes. And now it's harder to admit that they were wrong. But at some point we have to, because we're in a trap. Can't get out of until we can say those three magic words. I was wrong. But I sort of lost my train of thought. But trying to look here if I can regain it. Bonds. I was going to talk about bonds. The usual way of thinking is that the two asset classes are cash and bonds. And I think that's very outdated thinking. And I won't go into it in depth because I have a whole podcast. What should you be invested in when you're not invested in stocks? And that's mostly about bonds and why I don't really think bonds are the best alternative. I think for people who are knowledgeable about bonds, bonds can be a good investment. But the average middle-class investor, which is the person to whom I usually aim my material, is not sophisticated enough to know how to pick bonds intelligently. And if you're not sophisticated, my personal inclination is to go with something like TIPS or I-bonds or CDs, which are very simple to understand. You know, anybody can understand. I mean, CDs are as simple as it gets, and TIPS are pretty darn simple. And TIPS have inflation protection. See, bonds don't have that. Bonds are risky because bonds do not have inflation protection. If it wasn't for the possibility of big inflation, bonds would be a good investment class. But given the riskiness of bonds, given inflation, the reality of the modern day reality of high inflation, or at least the prospect of high inflation, bonds are a risky asset class. And if you're going to be in a risky asset class, why not just be in stocks? So anyway, I'm not a big fan of bonds. Although, as I say, I think for the sophisticated investor, bonds could be a great deal because not many people know about bonds on a deep level. So if you're willing to take the time to study them and to make good choices, I think you could do real well. But the type of person I write for is generally not willing to do that. So what you want to do in constructing a portfolio, as I said at the beginning, the job is to take on the right amount of risk. And it's very, very important to understand, when I say risk, I don't only mean risk of the asset class. There is a risk. The different asset classes have risk attached to them. And you certainly have to understand that. But that's only half of the game. Probably not the most important half. The more important half is the risk within you. Your personal circumstances determine, you know, how much of a loss you can take and for how long. And if you don't understand that, and if you don't factor that into your thinking, it's not that hard. Please don't be intimidated. You don't have to get it exactly right. You just have to get it roughly right, and you'll be fine. You know, don't make a big deal out of it, but just don't forget to do it. But unless you factor that in, you haven't looked at risk appropriately, in my opinion. So the whole game is about risk. And since you're trying to construct a portfolio with the right amount of risk, sort of my thinking goes like this. One, the job is to construct a portfolio with the right amount of risk. Two, you've got to have stocks in there, because if you don't have stocks in there, you're giving up on the asset class with the highest long-term returns, and you're delaying your retirement. So you've got to, you know, construct for risk, the right amount of risk. You've got to have stocks. What do you want as your counter to stocks? Well, my thinking is, since I've got to figure out a way to balance this and get the right amount of risk, and I've got to have stocks, the other thing I want is something that is the opposite of stocks. That'll help me. It'll help me, you know, it'll keep it simple. As I say, you could do it. You can do it with bonds and gold and all that. And you could, if you're willing to spend enough time on it, that's the best way to do it. That's the best way to invest. But most people aren't willing to spend the time. And if you get it wrong, you're going to hurt yourself. So if you want to keep it simple, I would lean towards saying construct a portfolio that has stocks, and I tend to say go with an index fund, you know, whether you want to go with a global fund or a U.S. fund, I would tend to go with a broad U.S. index fund, but, you know, there's different arguments. You could go with a global fund, you know, if you like. But counter that with cash, because cash is the most anti-stock asset class out there. This is the beauty of cash. People don't get this. People just toss cash away. It's like they're afraid to be in cash. They're thinking, well, you know, cash just doesn't have risk, and therefore it must be bad. And they just want to toss it out. But cash is wonderful. They talk all the time. The passive investing enthusiasts talk all the time about, what do they call it? Well, diversification. They certainly use that. And correlation. They'll say the way to diversify is to find asset classes with a reverse, you know, reversely, reverse correlation, that when one does well, the other does poorly. Well, stocks and cash are perfectly, they're perfect opposites. Stocks are extremely volatile in their price and offer extremely high long-term returns, and cash is extremely stable and offers extremely low long-term returns. They're perfect opposites. People just can't get their heads around the fact that that something that offers a low long-term return could be a good component of their portfolio. But it is. What makes cash so wonderful is it's the opposite of stocks. Oh, this is a theoretical idea. You're either going to get it or you're not, and I hope you get it. I wish there was a way I could say it so that everybody would get it. The job, I'm going to go through it again because it's important, and I hope that I can get it across. I hope I can. It's my job, and I want to do it. The job is to get the right risk. You see, you don't want to have too much risk any more than you want to have too little. You want to get it just right. That's the goal. If you get your risk right, you've invested effectively. You've got it. You've nailed it. So the whole job in setting up a portfolio is, how do I get the right amount of risk in there? Now, if you want to, you know, if you don't want to do stocks, I guess it could be relatively easy to get the right amount of risk in there. But you want to do mostly stocks because stocks offer the best return. So I accept that as a premise. I agree with the passive investors on that one. But where I get off the track is they say, oh, after stocks, I'm going to stick in bonds. And I say, why? What you're trying to do with your non-stock part of the portfolio is to counter the risk of stocks. Stocks are sometimes too risky, and you want to pull that risk down. And the thing that pulls risk down effectively is cash. So I say go with cash. Now, I think what throws them is when they hear pull risk down, it scares them because they say, oh, if I pull risk down, I'm pulling return down because risk is correlated with return. This is a premise of the passive investing model. But it's not true. What you're really doing is you're pulling real risk down. You are pulling risk down, but you're not necessarily pulling perceived risk down. And it's perceived risk that is correlated with return, not real risk. So if you pull down real risk, you are lowering your risk while increasing your return, because there are times when cash is perceived as high risk. So you're lowering your risk, which is great, and at the same time increasing your return because you're taking on more perceived risk. It's like heaven. It's the best of both worlds. Higher returns, lower risk. And you can only do that with cash. You can't do it with anything else, because only cash is the opposite of stocks. Only cash will do that for you. So cash is exciting. This is my message. Cash is exciting. And cash is strategic. The only thing that stops people from talking about this is the people that bought into passive investing. People are just stuck. It's like a broken record. It just goes round and round and round, saying the same thing over and over again. And they can't get to the next song because it's broken. And these are the questions we need to talk about. We need to have lots of people challenging what I'm saying so that we can advance our knowledge, not dismissing it, challenging it. Because that's how we learn. That's how we advance the ball. Now, a few points I want to make about cash. One, as I sort of referred to this earlier, but when I refer to cash, I'm not talking just about money markets. Something they do in the passive investing studies that drives me bonkers is, and they do this all the time, I mean, it seems universal, virtually universal. I don't think I've ever seen an exception. Whenever they do a study, they always slant the thing against cash. They always do this. They want stocks to look good. I mentioned Rob Arnott's quote. Something Rob Arnott said, that quote came from an article he wrote at Index Universe a few weeks ago. And one of the things he said in that article, another great quote, was he said, in this equity-centric world of ours, or this equity-centric business, or whatever he said, in other words, the focus is always on stocks. Stocks, stocks, stocks. See, that's, I think that's because that's where the money is. That's where the commissions are. So there's a huge overemphasis on stocks. As I say, and his article was arguing for bonds. And as I say, bonds are actually probably a good deal if you understand them. If you're Rob Arnott, I think you can do well with bonds. But I don't know if the average person can, because the media never talks about bonds. And so, you know, it's going to be hard for you to learn. I mean, you could do it if you're willing to roll up your sleeves and dig in. The information's there on the internet. But if you're self-motivated, go for it. But if you're not, then I'm not as excited about bonds for you. But this equity-centric universe is a problem, and this is the reason why they'll do these studies. And the standard thing they'll do is they'll compare stocks and cat, what they call cash, and the cash component will be made up of a money market fund, you know, or short-term treasuries. And they'll say, oh, cash gives you a long-term return of, you know, 1%, some pathetic number. And, is it technically correct? It's correct that if you looked at that asset class, you know, that's what you got. But it's like they're going out of their way to make cash look as bad as it can possibly look. Why would you do that? Why would you do that? Your purpose is to invest effectively. And the whole deal in setting your allocation, let's say that you've agreed with the first part of the podcast where I said, your allocation decision is how much stocks, how much cash. Well, the job in weighing the two is to say, okay, what kind of return can I get from the one, and what kind of risk do I have, and what kind of return can I get from the other, and what kind of risk do I have? Well, if you lie to yourself about what return you can get, you're obviously going to throw all your thinking off. How can you think clearly when you're lying to yourself about one side of the scales? John Graney used to do this to me all the time. I'd be posting at Motley Fool, and I'd say, you know, I have tips that pay 3.5% real. And he would say, oh, you know, Rob thinks he's going to do good, but, you know, he's only getting, you know, money markets only pay 1%. I'm not in money markets. Why are you quoting what money markets get? Oh, Rob, and he would just do it over. He did it thousands of times. But all he was really doing, you know, as bad as it is, I do call that deception. He knows that I'm not in money markets. So to quote the money market rate as my return is deception. I don't know what else you can call it. But what I will say in John's defense is all these other experts, they don't do it in regard to me, but they do it in general by always talking about cash as if you get 1% or whatever the number they pick is. You know, it's always some low number, and it's always based on what money markets pay or short-term treasuries. If you are interested in investing effectively, you know, John Walter Russell has a name for this. He calls it idiot switching. You know, it's the same phenomenon. They try to prove the timing doesn't work by timing in the most stupid way imaginable. And you know, surprise, surprise, it doesn't work. When you do it really, really stupid, it doesn't work. But if you had any sense at all, you wouldn't do it that way. And, of course, then you'd get good results. But this is common in this field. Common. It's just an everyday occurrence. They do this all the time. So, if you go rational, or if you become a valuation-informed indexer, you're not going to go and say, oh, wow, I see that I can get a CD today that's paying 1%. I'm going to grab it. I'm going to put all my money in it because that's the lowest rate I've ever seen. I love these low rates. I'll lock it up. I'm going to lock it up forever, that low rate. That's not what you're going to do. That's what they do in the studies. All these studies that show stocks for the long run, The mythical investors are locking in low returns on cash. And surprise, surprise, the result they come to, the conclusion they come to is stocks do better in the long term. Yeah, if you're the stupidest person on earth making your decisions. But if you have a little bit of common sense, what you're going to do is you're going to lock up good returns. So, for example, when tips were paying 4% real, people should have been buying them up like crazy. It was the deal of a lifetime. At that time, tips, there were 30-year tips paying 4% real for 30 years. So don't ever say, please, you know, that the rate on cash is bad. It's not as good as stocks. Stocks have an average return of 6.5 real. You're not going to get that in cash, that's for sure. But 4% isn't that far below. And that 4% was truly the deal of a lifetime. But I don't think 3% real is undoable. 3% real you can find in certificates of deposit. Not all the time. But if you look for a couple years, you can find it and you can lock it in. So I think 3% real is a reasonable number. Either through CDs or I-bonds or TIPS, whatever it is. But look for the best return, not the worst. And then the comparison between stocks and cash will be very different. Always, here's another rule. When you're trying to decide what your allocation is going to be and you're deciding between stocks and cash, always insist on a risk premium for stocks. My brother Steven, I feel, made this error. I talked to him a month or two ago and on the phone, and you know, he lost some money in the stock crash, and you know, like everybody else. And I said, Steven, it just kills me because, you know, I'm your brother. I mean, you know, we grew up together, we played baseball together, we played Monopoly together, and why didn't you give me a call? And he said, well, he said, I checked your calculator before I did it. And he said, your calculator said 2% for stocks. He said, that didn't sound so bad. Now, 2% for stocks is horrible. There was a time when the calculator said 2% for stocks before the crash. It's much higher now. But there was a time before the crash when it said that. But 2%, maybe it doesn't... Yeah, I'll tell you how people interpret it. I'll tell you what I think was in his head. Maybe he's not aware of it, but I'll tell you what I think. What I think is everybody knows there's all this spin going on. At some level of consciousness, we're aware of it. So what he probably did, or what a lot of people do, is they hear me say 2% for stocks, and they say, well, that Rob guy, he's a bear. You know, I don't believe there's such a thing as bears and bulls. But he's a bear. So he's giving the low number, 2%. And these other people that like stocks, they're saying maybe 10%. And so it's probably somewhere in the middle. It's probably somewhere between 2 and 10. And that doesn't sound too bad. Somewhere between 2 and 10 is like 6 maybe. You know, not too bad. That's how people think. Because the step they're missing in the logic chain is you don't just pick the most optimistic and the most pessimistic and presume the reality's in the middle. What you have to do is figure out who's right. Who's got the better logic? I have the better logic. I win. No, I mean, yeah, that's what I believe. Now, if you believe in the optimist guy, the 10% guy, well, go with his thing, you know. But if you believe what I'm saying, go with 2%, not 6. And I think that's probably what my brother did, maybe without thinking about it. He saw 2 and he said, you know, this guy really hates stocks. So, you know, it can't be any worse than that. It could be a lot worse than that. The 2% number isn't the worst case scenario. The 2% is the most likely scenario. It could be a lot worse than 2%. For the, you know, at the time my brother purchased stocks. So, but even if, you know, 2% is bad, why is it bad? It's a lot worse than it sounds. You know, it sounds not good, but it doesn't sound horrible, you know. In other words, at the time he looked it up and it said 2%, it may well have been that the tips were only paying 2%. So he might have said, well, they're both paying the same. So I'll just go with stocks. Most people seem to like stocks and, you know, they're about the same. Even my brother says it's not too much worse. Well, that's not right because the volatility for stocks is far, far greater. There's no volatility at all with tips, zero. And you should be getting compensated for being willing to take on that volatility. And if you're not getting compensated, you're a fool. And I think you should get at least 2% more than what you can get in a safe asset class when you're invested in stocks. Minimum, maybe 3%, but at least 2%. So to translate, the 2% real you get on stocks is equivalent to 0% real on tips. And 0% real on tips is not a good investment class. How are you going to ever retire if you're getting 0%? So 2% real on stocks is bad. Bad return. That's important to keep in mind when you're trying to do this balance. And again, even that shows, even that little illustration shows that cash is exciting, maybe not super exciting in that case. You know, 2% doesn't sound, I was saying maybe tips were paying 2% real at the time. That doesn't sound super exciting, but at least it's better than stocks. It's 2% without the volatility. So, you know, neither of those choices is super exciting, but at least you could say it's exciting to take the volatility out of the equation. So even in that scenario, which is a pretty bleak scenario where you can't get better than 2% anywhere, even in that scenario, cash is a little more exciting than stocks. But I want to take it a step further, and I want to show that cash is really a lot more exciting than that. I don't have the calculator in front of me, so I can't give you precise numbers, but I'll give you the concept. Let's say that you're looking at a time when my brother was looking to buy stocks, and the calculator says the most likely 10-year return on stocks is 2% real. And it just happens that the most likely return on tips is 2% real, or I-bonds. So you've got two choices. And I'm saying, you know, my brother said I'll go with stocks because I'd rather have stocks if they're the same. I say, you know, you should go with tips because the volatility is not there unless you get at least 2% higher. And I say that's slightly exciting, but not super exciting. It's really a lot more exciting than that. Here's why. When you go with the tips, the beginning of a 10-year period, and you're going to get 2% real from tips each year, and you're probably going to get something in the neighborhood of 2% real from stocks each year, I'm saying tips are better, partly because of the risk premium, you know, that you should get from stocks, but partly, for more importantly, for the next reason. If you put your money into the tips, the stock, the long-term number on stocks is going to be going up. 2%, the average return on stocks is 6.5. So when stocks are paying only 2%, the return on stocks is artificially low. You know that that return is going to be going up. You don't know when. We don't know when, but we know it's going to go up, and we know it's going to go up big time, which is another way of saying we know that there's going to be a stock crash. We know a stock crash is coming. When you get the return on stocks down to 2%, a stock crash is impending. That's exciting for the tips investor. Are you really going to get 2% on your tips? No way, no how. Here's what you're going to get. You're going to get 2% each year, guaranteed, no risk, no muss, no fuss. And at some point within those 10 years, there's probably going to be a big stock crash. And that stock crash is going to bring stock prices way down. And guess what you can do when your money is in CDs or tips or I-bonds? You can convert it to stocks. Say that we drop. I don't know what the P10 level was where it was 2%, but it was a high P10. It was obviously over 20. Say that we drop to a P10 level of 8, which is probably where we're headed in the next few years. We get to 8. Now's what the plug 8. Plug a P10 level of 8 into your calculator and see what the 10-year return is. I don't know the number, but it's somewhere near 14% real. It's a big number. Say that happens at the beginning of year 6. You bought your asset, you know, and then for 10 years, and the beginning of year 6, the return on stocks flips up to 14. Well, now you just take your money out. You might have to pay it. You'll probably have to pay a penalty of some sort. So what? You're changing your return from 2% real to 14% real. Who cares? What, you have to pay a penalty on your CD. Who cares? Do you see the beauty of this? Now, what is your 10-year return on your decision to put your money on tips? Is it 2%? It's not 2%. You got 2% for 5 of those 10 years, and you got 14% for 5 of those years. Your real return is 8% on average. 8%. Stocks were only giving 2% at the time. Do you see? When stock prices dropped and the return on, could say that my brother had invested in stocks at the beginning of that 10 years, and then we had this big crash, and the long-term return on stocks went up to 14%. Is he going to get the 14%? No, because he lost half of his money in the crash. So yeah, he's getting 14%, but on a portfolio that's half the size. It's not the same thing. If you put your money in the TIPS or the I-bonds or the CDs, you've got all the money there. You got more than you started with because you were getting 2% real each year. The cash investor is so far ahead. The stock investor after the end of the 10 years is, you know, might have 2%, might not. As I say, that's the most likely, but he's taking a risk on doing worse than that. The cash investor's got 8% real. And again, don't forget to add in compounding. You know, my brother is a couple years younger than me, 49. You know, he might still be kicking at 89. He might have 40 more years of compounding on all that money. That adds up. He'll be retiring many years sooner. If he makes the decision for cash. And that's exciting. Financial freedom is exciting, okay? It's more exciting than thinking you're a big shot and thinking you know everything about investing because you read a book on passive investing once upon a time. You know, forget that junk. This is where the action is, I believe. There's another way in which stocks are even more exciting. And then I'll close. We had this debate. There's a side of this debate that has never been fully explored, and it's hard. It's hard to explore it, and it has to be. I've explored it conceptually at times, but it needs to be explored with numbers. And John Walter Russell, who helps me with all the numbers, is reluctant to go into this, and I probably for good reason. It's hard to quantify, and I think he feels that if he does, it will sort of cheapen all the other work he's done. So I don't fault him, but it's important, but it's hard to quantify because we don't really have the data we need to do this properly. That's the problem. But I'm going to throw this concept out there because it's so important. You need to hear it. When I said that the old school safe withdrawal rate studies were analytically invalid, there were two arguments I made. This goes back to the very beginning, back to 2002. One of those two arguments has gotten all the attention, and that is the old school studies don't include the valuation level on the day the retirement begins. And without that, you can't calculate the safe withdrawal rate accurately because that's the biggest factor. So all those studies get the numbers wrong. That's old news. But there's a second factor. It's every bit as important, possibly more. It may be more important than the first one. The second factor is all of the numbers they use, you know, when they do the safe withdrawal rate calculations, and also when they do any of these other studies, it's not just safe withdrawal rate studies. That's just an example of the problem. They always assume that the investor is going to remain in stocks through the bull and bear cycles. Why do they assume this? They assume it for the reason Rob Arnott points to. We live in an equity-centric universe. They spin everything in favor of stocks. There is no evidence that a middle-class person can maintain a stock allocation through a bull and a bear cycle. I am not aware of one sliver of evidence that that's possible. None. Please spend some time thinking about this. The problem here that people have understanding this is we don't go through that many. In one lifetime, you'll probably only go through two cycles. So you don't get to experience it personally. In order to understand the significance of the bull bear cycle, you have to look at the historical data where we haven't had that many cycles, but we've had more than one or two. We've had, I guess, four. You know, I'm not talking about little bulls and little bears. I'm talking about secular bulls and secular bears, the big ones. You always have these little ups and downs. Those are meaningless. I'm talking about the big run-ups in price like we had from 75 through 2000 and the big drops like we've had from 2000 through today and going forward. Has any middle-class investor in history ever maintained a high stock allocation through an entire bull and an entire bear? It may be that there's one, but I don't know the person's name. And you don't either. I've never seen it reported. Why am I so doubtful as to whether anyone's done it? Well, consider what you would have to do. Do you know how much stock prices fell in the crash in that began in 1929? Which, the P10 level was not as high then as it was this time. It was 33 in 29. This time it went to 44. You know, that we're in totally uncharted territory this time. So the last time we got anywhere close to where we were this time, do you know what the stock drop was? 89%. 89%. So you're a middle-class person. You've been saving your whole life for retirement. You're a couple years away. You've got $1 million saved. You retire. You use a 4% withdrawal, you're going to take out $40,000 a year. And now, there's a stock crash, and you lose 90% of your portfolio. You're down to $100,000. What do? You take out another 40? Are you kidding? Are you kidding? You've got $100,000, you don't have a job. You're 65 years old. And you're going to take out $40,000 of it to live on? Get real. No one's going to do that. I asked that question to John Graney at Motley Fool. And Graney said, yeah, just I take it out. That's what the study says. This is how unrealistic our investing advice is today. It's all a sick joke. No rational human being is going to take $40,000 out of a $100,000 portfolio. Which means that all of the studies, not everyone, but most of them, developed during the passive investing era just don't work. They're just not realistic. They're not sensible. They're not real world. What you need to do when you're setting your risk of your portfolio, which is what I said, that's the whole ball game. The whole ball game is getting the risk right. You need to look at not only the riskiness of the asset classes, which is what I'm talking about when I say you can get 8% from tips if you calculate it properly, including the switch to stocks after the stock crash, or you can get 2% from stocks. And 8 is obviously better than 2. But the other factor you need to look at is even the 2 is dubious because you don't get the 2 unless you can hold that stock allocation. If you sell after the crash, you're not going to get 2. The number, you know, maybe you're going to get 0. Maybe you're going to get a negative number. You know, Taylor Larimore is the author of the book, The Bogleheads Guide to Investing, and he's talking about selling all his stocks. This is the guy who wrote the book, and he can't take it. And I'm not faulting him. He's just a human. But he miscalculated risk. That's what I fault him for. Not that he miscalculated risk, but I fault him for sticking to this passive investing strategy that caused him to miscalculate risk. When you see what damage it's done, abandon it. Jump ship. It doesn't work. If passive investing causes everyone who follows it to miscalculate risk, passive investing's bad news, says Rob Bennett. I don't know that any middle-class investor has ever done what all the passive investing studies assume that we will all do. And none of the studies work if you don't go with that assumption. The reality is over-investing in stocks at times of high prices, at times of insane risk, always causes you to sell your stocks at the bottom. People look back. All the time. This came up in the 90s. People would say, oh, these old people are so stupid. They lived through the 29 crash, and now they won't put their money in stocks. How dumb can you be? They're not dumb. Who are we to say they're dumb? How arrogant. They're not dumb. You know what they are? They're people who believed in passive investing in an earlier era, and they got burned, and they never forgot. It hurt so much, they never forgot. And all the people today shoving passive investing down our throats, 30 years from now, are going to refuse to get into stocks forever because of the pain they brought on themselves by giving in to this nonsense. You've got to be able to stick to the stock allocation or it doesn't work. And you can't stick to the stock allocation unless you calculate risk properly. So failing to count valuations doesn't just cause you to not understand what your return's going to be. That's only one negative. The even bigger negative is it makes it impossible for you to assess whether you'll be able to stick with the allocation or not. And if you fail to stick with the allocation, all bets are off. It's all out the window. Forget it. And guess what magical asset class can help you in this endeavor? What magical asset class can make it possible for you to actually buy and hold in a meaningful way? Not to talk the buy and hold talk like the passive investors do, but to walk the buy and hold walk like the rational investors do. It's called cash. Cash is the thing that makes it possible to hold. Because if you had a 20% stock allocation before the crash, like you would have had, if you had heard the accurate numbers, the valuation adjusted numbers, even a 50% stock crash would have only caused a 10% loss in your portfolio. And most emotionally balanced middle-class investors can tolerate a 10% loss. If you had 80% in stocks and you suffered a 40% loss in value, no. Very few of us can tolerate that. And even if you happen to tolerate it through the first crash, we've probably got another one coming up ahead. You're not going to make it through that one. It's a double whammy. Ignoring valuations is a double whammy. So when you're comparing, you know, the comparison I gave was stocks are paying a long-term return of 2%. Cash is paying a long-term return of 2%. I said it's dumb to invest in stocks because, first of all, you should be getting a risk premium. So the 2% in tips is a better deal. And then I said, second, it's not really 2. It's really 8. When you consider that you can flip your money into stocks after the crash and end up with an average return of the 10 years of 8, not 2. So cash is exciting. And then when you look at the real return you're going to get in stocks, given that you're probably going to bail out at the bottom, the real return you're going to get in stocks is not 2. It's probably a negative number. Maybe it's a negative 10%. In other words, you're going to invest at a time when the long, it's not a guaranteed return of 2. It's a long-term return for those who practice buy and hold of 2. If you sell after the crash, you don't get the 2. Get something a lot worse. Now I'll give one last bit of exciting news for cash, and then I'll let it drop. The really exciting thing is what I'm telling you when I tell you that stock investors cannot effectively practice buy and hold because they have no idea how much risk they're taking on, because they didn't look at valuations, because passive investing says they don't matter, can't time the market. I told you they obviously don't get 6.5, do they? Because they're selling after a crash. So the passive investors aren't getting 6.5, but the average return is 6.5. So somebody's got to be getting, if a big group of investors and people who don't look at valuations is a big group, it's probably 80%. If a big group is getting a lot less than 6.5, then there's got to be a small group getting a whole lot more than 6.5. I don't know what the number is, but it's got to be a lot higher than 6.5. If the passives are getting that much less and the average is 6.5, somebody's making a whole lot more. That someone could be you. That someone could be you. What the passive investors will tell you is, that's a free lunch. That can't be so. There's no such thing as a free lunch. Well, I have a podcast saying that there is such a thing as a free lunch. But it's not. One of the arguments I make in that podcast is, it's not an entirely free lunch. If you follow these principles, you're earning. You're going to get a big return, and it might sort of sound like a free lunch, but it's not really. Because look at what that investor had to do. I was talking about my brother, and I was saying he should have went into tips instead of stocks at 2%. Look at what he had to do to get it. It didn't come free. Say that if he had done that, he would have ended up with a long-term return of 8% real. Did he earn that? And the stock investor would have had, you know, negative number. Did he earn, say it's a 10% differential, 10% more per year. Did he earn that 10% differential? I say he did, because here's what he had to do. First of all, he had to care enough to calculate this in advance, which the passive investors didn't do. So he earned it that way. And two, he had to live through 5 years of getting only 2% real. That's what you're being compensated for when you get these huge returns from cash. In other words, if you're willing to put your money in cash and you don't know when the crash is coming, you've sort of got to just sit still and wait for it. The market compensates you for that handsomely, but you have to do it. If everybody did it, it's true that the return would go down. You would only get 6.5 if everybody did it. The reality is everybody doesn't do it. The reality is this approach to investing is controversial. That's the reality. Well, thank God for controversial asset allocation strategies, says I. I'd rather invest controversially and get an 8% real return than invest conventionally and get a negative 2% return. That's my thought. Cash is exciting. Cash is a strategic asset class. Cash is not just for an emergency fund. You should be giving serious thought to cash. Not at all times. There will come a day when stocks will offer a far better long-term value proposition than cash. In those days, put most of your money in stocks. But we've just lived through a 13-year time period when cash had stocks beat every which way you can imagine. And if you come to understand that, I think you'll be a more effective investor for the rest of your life. So give some thought to the idea that cash can be a strategic asset class, just like stocks, just like bonds. Let me know if you have any thoughts. Click that Contact Rob button on the left side of every page at PassiveSaving.com. Good luck with your investing strategy.